Well, thank you, Ted. That was very kind. It reminded me of being on a program with the distinguished psychiatrist, Abram Tversky, who was a medical director at St. Francis Hospital for a number of years. And in the introductions, when you introduce a guy like Tversky, you could be there for 4 days. I mean, accomplishment after accomplishment. And as this guy was droning on about all of his accomplishments, Tversky leaned over me and he said, "I cannot wait to get home to meet myself." Rosa Parks died in 2005, and yet her legacy, I think, lives on in a most creative and dynamic way among us. Douglas Brinkley, who was an historian, University of Virginia, once said that this simple common woman affected humanity in nearly every corner of the world, beginning in Montgomery, Alabama, extending into South Africa, ultimately into Poland, wherever it was that people, for whatever reason, were subjected to unfair and inhuman treatment. Upon her death in 2005, while she was living in Detroit at that time, I think it's important to notice how a nation observed her passing. Her body was flown from Detroit to Montgomery, Alabama, which was her home, and their memorial service was conducted in the St. Luke's African Methodist Episcopal Church. I'd like for you to tuck that away. Yeah. Where Condoleezza Rice, former Secretary of State, was the main speaker. And this woman rose to her feet and with tears in her eyes said, "I would not be here today if it had not been for the Christian witness of Rosa Parks." Her body was then flown from Montgomery, Alabama, to our nation's capital, where she resided in state in the National Rotunda. She was the first woman to ever be so honored, and she was only the second African American to be so honored. Following those days of mourning in which nearly 7,000 people walked past that casket, she was flown back to Detroit, where at the Greater Grace Baptist Temple, there was a 7-hour memorial service that over 25,000 people attended. And what's also curious to me is that her garb as she lay in the casket was not about jewelry and a special gown, but rather she was viewed in her deaconess uniform, a symbol of a servant, which was the manner in which she lived her life and therefore was appropriately remembered. And so where does Rosa Louise McCauley come from? Well, she was born in 1913 in Tuskegee, Alabama. Her mother, Leona, was a school teacher, and she had struggled in order to achieve a certificate that allowed her to teach, of course, only black children. Her father, James, was a carpenter, and because his work often took him away from the home, and in addition to that, because he had a roving eye relevant to other women, Leona decided to divorce James because she wanted her daughter to have an appropriate model. And so this young woman, Leona, gathered up her daughter Rosa and her younger brother Sylvester, and they moved to a little small town just outside of Montgomery, and there they resided with Rosa Parks' maternal grandparents. They were pretty special people. They were people who believed in education, even though at that point They were hired laborers in the cotton fields of Alabama. They were people who also endorsed the role of women, not only in the home and the family, but in the wider community. And again, they were faithful attenders and supporters of the local African Methodist Episcopal Church. Note that again, where they provided leadership and support. Rosa Parks, in her book, Quiet Strength, talks about what it was like to be a little black girl living on the edges of Montgomery. These are some of her memories. She remembered that as she and her colleagues would walk to a black school, rain, sunshine, whatever, oftentimes they would be passed by a school bus. In that day and time, black kids walked to school. White kids were driven to school. Here's another memory. She talks about what it was like to be a little black girl growing up in the edges of Montgomery, seeing the KKK parade down the main street of that little town known as Lone Pine. And she remembered that as that parade unfolded, her grandmother, armed with a loaded shotgun, stood in the breach of their home, lest they be targeted. Eventually, she found her way through grade school, and she went off to something called the Industrial School of Montgomery. It had been staffed and begun by a group of Northerners that today we might call liberals. And all that meant was this: they understood what it was like to be a black kid walking to school, passed by a bus. They understood what it was like to be a black kid watching the violence and the hatred of the Ku Klux Klan. And therefore they began this school known as the Industrial School of Montgomery. She was only able to attend there for 3 years, because the school was burned down twice. And the second time, there was no resource to rebuild it. She remembers what it was like to be physically abused. Not sexually by her family, but physically by white people. And she remembers early on that she wanted to resist, based upon what her grandma and grandpa taught her. She remembers also that there was some folk in her beginnings who were white and who were good people. But what she also remembers about those white good people was that they did nothing. They did nothing to change her plight. Eventually, she met a fellow whose name was Raymond Parks. Raymond Parks was a barber. He was also a founder and a supporter of the Montgomery chapter of the NAACP. He was one of the first leaders of vote registration. He was an accomplished reader. And like his wife, Rosa, he too belonged to the African Methodist Episcopal Church. To show you the kind of guy he was, he made sure that his wife finished her GED and was finally awarded her high school diploma. He invited his wife to be a part of his involvement in the NAACP. And at that time, she was the only woman involved. And in her book, she writes humorously about the fact that eventually she was nominated and elected to
to be the secretary of that local chapter. And she remembers in the book that she was elected to that position, which incidentally she held for over 25 years, because she was the only woman in the group, and during that era, secretary was always a woman. Due to her involvement in the NAACP and a man whose name was Edgar Nixon, he was the chairman of that group and a strong advocate. Are you ready for this? A strong advocate of responsible action. Her life became a life of activism. And there was a woman whose name was Racy Taylor. She was a relatively middle-aged, attractive black woman who was gang raped by 25 white men. Her plight and her situation was put under the rug, except for this little woman whose name was Rosa Parks, who remembered what it was like to watch school buses go by and be afraid in the night because of a parade, and to be called a terrible name, and to be sometimes physically abused. And so this little woman decided she would become the spokesperson for Racy Taylor. She raised over $5,000 in a defense fund. Unfortunately, the 25 white men walked free. But she had had her day in court. She began to look for some work, and she finally was hired as a housekeeper at the Maxwell Air Force Base outside of Montgomery, Alabama. For her, the lesson of that experience was rather interesting, because it was a federal facility. Segregation was not allowed. And so her work and her interactions and relationships at that Air Force base were consistently open and affirming. However, at the end of the day, when it was time to go home, Rosa Parks had to board a segregated trolley system. And she began to wonder about the fact that as long as segregation and racism lived anywhere, it lived everywhere. And she wondered if it would ever be possible, think about this, she wondered if it would ever be possible for a young, accomplished black woman to ride a trolley and sit where she chose. She finally quit that job because the anxiety was just too much for her. She couldn't handle it. She was beginning to feel a deep sense of resistance. And she went to work for a white liberal couple whose name was Durr, D-U-R-R. She was their housekeeper. She took care of their children. But more importantly, they developed a relationship. And they began to encourage this woman to do something about what it was that she was feeling. And so they sent her to something that was called the Highlander Folk School. It's located in Montgomery. It's still there. And the fundamental thesis of that organization is to teach people how to become responsible activists. Their whole enterprise deals with how it is that you most significantly impact racial and cultural biases. As she was learning about skills and procedures, Emmett Hill, a young black man who was accused of flirting with a white woman, was brutally beaten and ultimately killed on the streets of Montgomery. That was a turning point in the life of this young woman. And she wondered what it would have been like if Emmett's name had been Sylvester, the name of her brother. And as a result of that wondering, Rosa Parks, in November of 1955, went to a mass remembrance of this young boy. It was a spiritual awakening for her. It was a moment of emotional energizing. It was a moment in which she began to believe that unlike white people with whom she had grown up, she was not going to be guilty of doing nothing. She didn't know what, but she was going to do something. 4 days later, on December the 1st, Rosa Parks finished a long day as a seamstress in a local Montgomery department store. She stood at the bus stop waiting for the bus to arrive, as it did. She boarded the bus and she sat in the front row of the colored section. And as the bus made its way along the route, more and more white people were getting on the bus. And so it was that the bus driver, a man by the name of James Blake, decided to change the rules. And he decided that he would move the sign that said colored section back a row. As he did that and passed by Rosa Parks, she remembered something. She remembered that he was the same man who was driving the bus in 1943 when she had gotten on the bus and paid her fare, and he said, "You can't do it that way. You have to get in the back door, come around, pay your fee." And as she was put off the bus with that procedure in mind, he drove off, leaving her standing there in the rain. Can you imagine the energy that must have grown up out of that memory? And so as James Blake was moving the sign, he said to Rosa Parks, "If you want your life to be light, you better move." She was sitting in that section with three adult black males. All three of them got up and moved. She didn't. She didn't. The bus driver said, "Either you move or I'm going to call the police." She did not move. And so James Blake called the police, and they came, and they arrested Rosa Parks, charging her with disorderly conduct and violation of a local ordinance. She was taken off to jail, and in the book, Quiet Strength, she talks about the conversation that she had with the police officer who had arrested her. And this is what she asked him. "Why do you treat us this way?" She says the police officer thought for a moment and said, "You know, I don't know. I really don't know." She was taken to the local judge. She was processed. And she had her day in court. She was fined $10 for the violation so cited, and they attached to it $4 for court fees. However, her case, had it not been for the NAACP, would have been perfunctory. But instead, it became an icon. And here's an important thing to remember. Remember the Highlander School? Responsible activism. Two other women within 2 years of Rosa Parks' action had done the very same thing. But both of them had not been supported by the local NAACP. And this is the reason. Edgar Nixon thought that the conduct and the language of those two women was unacceptable. They used profanity against their white accusers. They kicked and clawed. And as Edgar Nixon said, they acted in a way that was not becoming of blackness. Rosa Parks was the pinnacle of impeccable behavior. Aside from a question posed to a cop, she acted with a decorum that was beyond reproach. And so it was that Rosa Parks and the case that ensued initiated the beginnings of the civil rights movement. Douglas Brinkley writes, had there been no Rosa Parks, there may not have been any Martin Luther King Jr. Her actions had a couple of results. Number one, ultimately, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled that the actions of that bus driver and of that bus company and of the rules of the city of Montgomery were unconstitutional. The bus company was fined into oblivion. The city of Montgomery needed to change its law. And yes, it took 381 days of black people boycotting the bus system in Montgomery, Alabama. But when the dust had settled, this unassuming but also profound seamstress had conducted herself in a way that caused change. Yes, she became an icon. She also became a target. During the period after her boycott of that seating arrangement, she received over 30 death threats a day. Due to her actions, she was terminated by the department store because they felt she was not a good representative of their firm. Her husband, the barber, was dismissed by the man for whom he worked because he had discussed the actions of his wife with the clientele. Their life in Montgomery, Alabama became, it just was not sustainable. She feared for her well-being and for the well-being of her husband. And eventually they moved to Hampton, Virginia. And in Hampton, Virginia, she became a secretary receptionist at the Hampton Institute for Negroes. That's what it was called. And she worked there with distinction, because Rosa Parks had become a person of significance. But after a while, the hate and the threats found their way to Hampton, Virginia as well. And so her brother Sylvester and his wife, who by this time had moved to Detroit, Michigan, suggested that perhaps Rosa and Raymond should come there. Because interestingly enough, Detroit, during this era of the late 50s, had really begun to be progressive in terms of dealing with race relations. Contrary to some of the sadnesses that we've seen happen in Detroit over the last 20 years, in the 50s, it was sort of a model city, trying to create open housing, open education, and resisting the tendencies of segregation. And so she and her husband moved to Detroit, and she continued her social activism there. He got a job as a barber. She was interested in voter registration. She was interested in segregation and housing. But her most interesting involvement came with a man whose name was John Conyers. John Conyers was one of the first African Americans to be elected to the House of Representatives. She became a part of his campaign, knocking on doors, passing out petitions. And eventually, Conyers won his seat. And when he did, his first official action was to hire Rosa Parks as his administrative assistant running his Detroit office. She maintained
that position until 1988, when she retired. During the 70s, Rosa Parks' life was tough. She buried her husband as a result of throat cancer. She buried a brother who died of intestinal cancer. She had to drop out of an attempt to get a teacher certificate because her mom was so sick that she needed to be at home. And as she moved into the 80s, she found herself being a widow alone without too much resource. But interestingly enough, she had formed a letter relationship with the black leader, Malcolm X. Now, Malcolm X, obviously, was an extremely controversial figure, a man who had ideas that many found offensive. But he was a good friend to Rosa Parks. And Malcolm X suggested to her that America needed to hear her story. And so Rosa Parks began to write a very simple but profound autobiography. She began to go on the speaking tour. And all the money that she raised, she gave to the movement. As the 90s approached, she found herself in very precarious financial difficulties. And she was eventually evicted from her apartment because she had failed to pay the rent. She had failed to pay the rent because she was beginning to suffer from dementia. And so the local Baptist church in Detroit raised enough money to pay her rent. The apartment complex, realizing who Rosa Parks was, said she could live there rent-free for the rest of her life. And while it is that in 2005 she died of natural causes, it's important to say that she died without very much money. She did not have very much in the way of means, but Rosa Parks had made a difference. Now, that's her story, that's her history. And what I'd like to do now is talk a little bit about how she got there. From where do people like that come? What is their genesis? Whenever we talk about Rosa Parks, as I have been suggesting a couple points, we need to think about the African Methodist Episcopal Church. That was the church that her grandparents attended down there in Lone Pine. That was the church that she and Raymond belonged when they moved to Montgomery. That is the church that they went to in Detroit. The AME church began in Philadelphia under the leadership of a man whose name was William Allen. William Allen was a pastor who got tired of his people needing to sit up in the gallery. He got weary of being told someday. And he became associated with an organization that was simply called Free African Society. Their major thrust was to desegregate the Methodist Church. And during this period, you may or may not know that the Methodist Church was a segregated community. In fact, in 1840, my denomination, was broken apart. Not because of theological differences, oh no. Not because of worship context, no. Because of the question of whether or not it was ethical to own slaves. The Methodist Church South said absolutely. And that effort was led by a group of bishops. The Methodist Episcopal Church North said not so sure. But both groups continued to have the gallery.
And that is why William Allen decided he had had enough. And in Philadelphia, he started the African Methodist Episcopal Church. And one of their primary foci had to do with eradicating slavery and, of course, racism. That was the tradition out of which Rosa Parks came. Brinkley is very clear about this. Rosa Parks and her activism did not originate because she was a tired old black lady. It rose up out of a tradition that had said, enough is enough. It's time to do something. And so, as we think about that tradition and her association with it, as I said to Sarah and Ted, I'm convicted about how timely her origins are for us. We're living in an age when I think the church needs to recapture its sense of doing something. We live in an age when silence is an anathema. Who was it once said, all that evil needs to survive is for good people to do nothing? And Rosa Parks, in a theological context, I think, raises for us a model of the church that really is involved in the social realities of our age. She teaches us that one of the primary purposes of the church is not self-preservation. It is the enhancement of the human condition. She also teaches us that one of the responsibilities of the church is to raise up leaders. And you know, when we think about leaders, too oftentimes we think about credentialed people. We think about power brokers. And Rosa Parks stands in total contrast to that. Rosa Parks understood that leadership is about doing something with a little bit of class. And so when Douglas Brinkley describes Rosa Parks, this is a quotation I use from him. He said, she was more than a tired, older, dignified lady. She was a progressive, believing, Christian activist whose faith moved the mountain. I think that might be the first legacy of Rosa Parks. What is the purpose and the function of the church? Number two, Rosa Parks was a Bible Christian. In her book, Quiet Strengths, she remembers how it was that the Bible in that home where she lived with her grandparents, the Bible was read every morning. She remembers that as a child, she was expected to memorize Scripture. She remembers that the Bible was not a part of their life. The Bible was at the center of their life. And while it was that Rosa Parks herself was not a profound biblical scholar, while it was that her grandpap certainly was a profound biblical scholar, both of them both learned and shared this idea. The Bible is a textbook for how it is that we are to live together in the world as God's servant. For Rosa Parks, the Bible needed to be read, remembered, studied, critiqued, and then most critically, applied. Rosa Parks was an individual for whom the Bible was indeed the marching orders for Christians. And if you think about it, it makes a little sense. For example, James Conn, unfortunately died last year, but he was a great theologian, taught at Union for years, a black man who wrote about black theology and black power. He once said that the story of the Exodus, while it is about the Israelites in Egypt building the pyramids, it's really a story about all of us. It's a story about people anywhere who are beset by some sort of injustice. And how it is that as we read the story of the Exodus, as I suggested last week, what do we find there? Ooh, a competent woman who wove a basket and then made it boyable and then put a kid in there and arranged for that child to be found by a power broker. And James Conn reiterates what it is that Rosa Parks was all about. That night that she got on that bus, she was a part of the Exodus story. And she made a difference, even as Moses, returning to Egypt, did the same. And what does that mean for us? Well, you're going to have to excuse me a little bit here, because while I'm an old man, I still have a little fire in my bones. One of the fire in my bones is this. You know, I'm tired of Bible study. I'm tired of the canned stuff that we get spoon-fed. And I'm really tired of the fact that as a result of our Bible study, sometimes not very much happens. My mentor in graduate school is a man by the name of Carl Michelson. Mike was a little bit on the edge. He thought outside the box. I'll give you that. In fact, the New York Times once described Carl Michelson as a man of deep and profound faith who acted like a prize fighter. What does that mean? That means when Michelson lectured, you listened. And when you wrote a dumb, stupid paper and hurried up to get it in on time, you failed. And when he spoke in chapel, Carl Michelson was about making the wonder of Jesus a reality. And this is what he once said about Bible study. He said, too often, Bible study is little more than shared ignorance. That's not true with Rosa Parks. The Bible was a centrality issue in her life. It gave her marching orders, not only how to resist the wrongs and the injustices of her time, but how to do that with impact. Third concept I think she deals with. It's the concept of prayer. Her grandfather had prayer before they ate their meal. Her grandfather had prayer before they began the day. And before they went into the fields of Alabama to pick cotton, grandfather led prayers. Prayer was a part of her daily experience and thought. And when you read about her understandings of prayer, this is what you determine. Prayer for her was not a laundry list. You know, reminds me of the great story about a Catholic priest who was once invited by one of his parishioners to go to a boxing match. And the parishioner noticed that just before one of the combatants stood up to begin the first round, he crossed himself and appeared to pray.
To which the man finally said, "Father, do you think that's going to help him win?" To which the priest responded, "Yes, if he can box." So Rosa Parks wasn't interested in saying, "Hey, God, can you help me with this?" Her interest was not in terms of offering to God alternatives. It wasn't a laundry list. That doesn't mean that she didn't raise concerns in prayer. It meant that she raised them out of a sense of vulnerability. Number two, for her, prayer was all about something called discipline. And what I mean by that is, she understood in prayer where her strength came from. It didn't come from her mind. It didn't come from her spirit. It came from God. In fact, in her autobiography, Rosa Parks, My Story, she recounts what happened to her that night as she sat in that seat with that driver saying, "You got to move." She said, "I prayed. I don't remember the words. I just know that the Spirit of God embraced me." Three, prayer for her was all about listening. Prayer was certainly about expressing life, of course. But ultimately, it was about listening. My mentor, Michelson, offered a seminar simply entitled Prayer. It was a two-hour seminar that went on Tuesday afternoons from 4 to 6. The first session came. Michelson said, "Gentlemen, here's your bibliography. I suggest you begin to read." And that was it. For 2 hours, we sat there in silence. Next week rolled around. We go back. Mike says, "Hope your reading is going well." Silence. So, some of the guys in the class said to me, "Operly, you are his guy. Have a talk." Sure. Sign me up for that one. So I gathered up a little bit of courage I did have. And I knocked on Michelson's door, and he invited me in. And I stumbled around. I mean, how do you critique a guy like that? And finally, I got it out. I said, "Dr. Michelson, some of the members of the class are wondering when you're going to begin to teach us something." Michelson said, "I am teaching you something. I'm teaching you how to listen." It's also interesting that Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote a wonderful little book. It's called Life Together, where he lists the various ministries of the church. And the one at the very top is the ministry of listening. Rosa Parks prayed not to tell God what she thought ought to happen, but rather to listen for that still small voice that speaks with a thunderous implication. Next, Rosa Parks developed what I'd like to call this morning a Christian worldview. And what I mean by that is, she looked at the world through a lens that was decidedly Christian. And when she did that, she reached a couple of conclusions. Number one, she recognized that there is a significant difference between human law and divine law. She recognized that sometimes
The laws of a culture are not consistent with the law of God. And interestingly enough, she found that to be evident in the scriptures. Because we hear these words, in Christ there is neither slave nor free, Jew nor Greek, male or woman. And then you flip over a couple of pages, and what do you find? Well, now, if you have something to say there, Mary, you tell your husband, and he'll bring it to the church. So you can see that that early church must have been very conflicted by those two rules. Her notion is that as a Christian looking at the world, you have to be able to differentiate that. Number two, she also believed that once you differentiate it, it is not inconsistent at all for a Christian to disobey that law. She believed that based upon faith, that Bible, that prayer experience, whenever you encountered a law, no matter its origin, that was juxtaposed to the law of God, it was inconsistent not to do something about it. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, huh? I'm sure you've all know about that guy. You know, what did he do? He tried. He spoke out against Hitler. He came to America, studied the communism, went back to Germany, went on the radio. Then he began the underground seminary. Then he began the underground church. And at the end of the day, guess what? You still had 6 million Jews being killed. So what did Dietrich Bonhoeffer do? He became an active member of the plot to assassinate, kill Adolf Hitler. I once sat in a seminar on Bonhoeffer led by John Gotze. And back in the day, this is your experience, back in the day, the graduate school had two defining realities. First one was you had to have a briefcase. If you didn't have a briefcase, you were just dumb, you know. And the other thing you had to do was a pipe. Remember those days? Yeah. And I'm sitting in this seminar with these dudes who have briefcases and pipes, and we're studying Bonhoeffer. I find this one guy speaks up. You know what he says? He said, you know, Bonhoeffer's a great theologian, but he has no credibility. Excuse me? Why doesn't he have credibility? He participated in the taking of human life. That's right, he did. He believed that the law of the state of Germany that said Jews need to be killed was wrong. And it was not inconsistent at all for him to say Hitler needs to go. You may quarrel with that, and that's a good thing to have that dialogue, because that kind of thinking can be abused too. But for Rosa Parks, a worldview wrestled with that. Here's the third thing about her worldview that I think is really interesting. It is what the Dalai Lama refers to as compassion. Now, when we use the word compassion in English, I think we miss its point. Because inherent in the word compassion is the word passion. And Rosa Parks practiced based upon a worldview of a compassion or a passion that believed so much in what she was about that she was actually able to understand and forgive the people who treated her so badly. Rosa Parks was a woman who stayed above the levels of her tormentors. She was a person who was so committed in a passionate way to what it is that she believed to be God's purposes that she refused to compromise that by acting badly. That is why she never endorsed Malcolm X. Because she believed that his approach was based upon hate and violence rather than compassion and love. And you know, when you think about the great leaders of all times, do you ever notice how that characteristic emerges? Let's think about Nelson Mandela, huh? 27 years in a jail, most of which was spent in isolation. His day on the beach was being permitted into the yard where they broke big rocks into little rocks. So compromised was his health by that activity that he nearly went blind because they refused to give him sunglasses. During that period of time, he lost his mother. And the only way he knew that that had happened was he read about it in a paper smuggled into him by a guard. During that time, he lost two children to death. And finally, when Robert the Clerk said, "Enough's enough, we're done with that crap," Nelson Mandela emerged as a compassionate, caring, decent man who said to the ghettos, "We are not going to kill Afrikaners. We're going to live together." And the great movie, The Invictus, celebrates that. And lastly, Rosa Parks was a living I see people leaving. I think I must be doing something wrong. It's always annoying. You know what I'm saying? She was truly a person who understood discipleship. What is this? What is Christian discipleship? Well, I think it's certainly more than a creedal statement. It's more than a kind of a religious kind of thing. Barbara always laughs about this, and it is funny. Every year at the college, every semester you get evaluations by your students. You know, they fill the form out. And so several months ago, as she was reading over them, she found this one. She found it funny. I do too. This kid wrote, "You really need to take this course, especially if you're not religious." So that's what can I tell you. So for her, discipleship was more than religious. Here's what it was. It was a point of demarcation. Here's what Bonhoeffer meant when he said, "Costly grace represents a change, a point of reference that's new. Number two, it's also an orientation that you don't outlive. You don't just apply it here or there. It's something that you are. It also means a commitment to make life better, to enhance the human condition. And I think it means moving beyond the present and certainly the past." Come on. The past is the past. The present is fleeting. Don't you think it might be a good idea to look toward the future? My mentor, Harold Roy Brennan, used to say to me as I was learning how to preach. Unfortunately, I failed the course, but that's all right. "Jack," he'd say. And when Roy Brennan spoke to you, you listened, by the way. He was blind in one eye. And when he got a little bit excited, that eye would kind of roll around, and you knew that you were in for some trouble. And he said to me, "Jack," he said, "when you preach and you hear a baby whimper or a little kid cry out, remember, that's not an intrusion. You're listening to the future." Not a bad idea. And discipleship is not about yesterday. It's not even about that much. It's about building a future, a dream, a vision that moves people forward. Douglas Brinkley wrote of her these words: "Discipleship is not what Rosa Parks did. It was something that she was." And in conclusion, when Nelson Mandela welcomed Rosa Parks to South Africa,
as she made her way to the podium to be recognized in that deep and resonant voice that he had, he began this chant, "Rosa, Rosa, Rosa, Rosa." And after a while, people caught up in that chant, "Rosa, Rosa, Rosa." And by the time she reached the podium, that entire auditorium was standing on its feet chanting those words. And as she approached Mandela, a man who had been incarcerated for 27 years, a man who knew how to handle the system, wept, and later said, "I cried because I stood in the presence of greatness." That's why I've selected Rosa Parks as a woman to look at during this seminar. I think she lives as an example in our hearts and minds of what it is that we are called to be. We have a couple of moments. Maybe you want to challenge some of that stuff, because I was pretty much on the edge there a little bit once in a while. But yes, please, sir.
Pick up on your thoughts with regard to the A&E Church being born to do something. Mm-hmm. And you said, I think there was criticism of today's church.
Yes.
We're not doing something. Pick up on your thoughts on what the church is.
You're right on. That's where I am. My thought is this. We as the church may not always have the answer. And I'd be the last guy in the world to suggest that there are simple, easy answers. But in the spirit of Paul Tillich, I think it's important to listen to and even encourage the questions. So when I talk about the church doing something, I believe that we need to be listening to the issues of our time and interacting with those issues, not as the great truth giver, but rather as a fellow pilgrim trying to figure it out. Let me illustrate what I mean by that. A couple of years ago, the president of our college said to me, "Jack, I was wondering, would you be willing to chair a presidential commission to look at our relationships on the campus as a community?" Well, being the token Protestant there, I decided, oh, this might be a good way to embarrass some Catholics. So I decided to take the job. Boy, has that been a life learning experience. I'll tell you why. I always figured I had homosexuality figured out. I was raised as a homophobic. During my years of college, Barbara and I were together when we were at Bethany. There were, two or three black students there, period. Then I went to Drew and I met in this guy, Michelson. And I began to read James Caan. And then I met Ed James, who's a physician in Coriopolis. I met Charlie Fugit, who was the president of Indiana University of Pennsylvania, who's a black man. And my life began to open up. And then I met, more recently, a man by the name of Russell Clark. Russell Clark graduated from our college yesterday. And Russell Clark is gay. And my relationship with that young man has been so helpful to me for two reasons. It's given me a good understanding, not a perfect one, but a better one, of what it means to be gay. Number two, Russell has also helped me to understand that not all gay people are nice people. And until you're able to stand in that matrix, you're either a homophobic or you're somebody who has their eyes closed. So my struggle today, relevant to that question, you all know this, in my denomination, we are in serious trouble on this problem. We had a conference in February, whenever it was, and my denomination voted to once again restrict gay people from being ordained, and actually spoke punitively of gay marriage.
The thing that bothers me the most about where our denomination is this. On both sides of that question, we got too damn many people who are unwilling to struggle with the question. They want to give you the answer, but they don't want to struggle with the question. So when I talk about the church doing something, believe me, I'm not interested in being the savior of the world. I got that. I pretty much gave that up a long time ago. But I do think that it's important for the church to have good interaction, conversation questions with young men like Russell Clark. Russell Clark is Catholic, by the way. And one night in a session, we were sitting together talking, he began to cry. I think the Catholic Church needs to hear that. One of my associates back along the way was a young man who was gay. And he came into my office one day and he shut the door. I thought, oh boy, what did I do now? He sat down, he said, I need to tell you something. Said, what's that? He said, I'm gay. I kept that our secret. Because if he had come out, they would have restricted his ordination and booted him out of the system. I learned what it was like to struggle. But also from both of these guys, I've learned that sometimes they need to be critiqued. They need to be, you know, hey, come on, give it a program here, kind of thing. So that's what I'm about. And I don't mean to, believe me, I hope you don't take away from that answer that I'm not interested in reaching conclusions. No, that's not the point. I am interested in reaching conclusions. But I'm more interested in the church forgetting about whether or not we're going to have tea and coffee and interacting with the questions of our time. And it's not only the issue of gay rights. We still have a big problem with segregation in this country. We all know that. We have a big problem with women's issues in this country. I think we have a big problem with poverty. How about mental health? How about drug addiction? It used to be drug problems were what black kids had where I grew up. I'll bet you go out on the street here right now, it might not be too long until you bump into something that says, nice white affluent kids have some issues too. So my thing is the church, in the spirit of Rosa Parks, needs to have that kind of engagement. And I've discovered, we sometimes can't remember who each other is, and that gets very embarrassing. You know what I'm saying? I say, hey, Barb, how are you? And she says, who are you? Anyway, we have discussions about where we've been, what we're doing. And, you know, I think, and you can speak for yourself on this, but I think we share this common idea. We long for the church to be the church. Not a club, not a social organization, the church. Now that doesn't mean it can't be a club, a relationship, of course not. But it does mean we are mandated by Jesus, I think, in the spirit of the Bible. Prayer, by the way, your guy, John Calvin once said, you can only read the Bible if you pray. And prayer is what she defined, what I think she doing. I don't know if that gets to where you are, but that's where I am at the moment. And I distrust answer guys. This will fix it. Well, maybe not. We've heard a lot of that lately. It may not fix it. So let's continue the discussion. Anybody else want to offer a critique or a comment? Well, all right, then next week, if you want to come back, you may not want to, but sorry. If you don't come back, send money, all right? That's what I used to tell my parishioners. I don't care if you come, just send money. Sorry. Next week, we're going to take a look at Mother Teresa. Again, a stellar human being that I think, even though she's gone from us, she still has a profound impact. By the way, did you hear about the pastor who was having health problems? And he went to the doctor. I said, man, you're studying for, you have a real serious blood disorder. What am I going to do about that? Well, he says, I'm going to give you this medicine. He says, you clear it up. He said, the only problem is it's $1,000 a month. $1,000 a month? He said, I can't afford that. Not to worry, said the doctor. You can get the same medicinal effect with 2 ounces of brandy once a day. Oh, he said, I couldn't do that. He said, I'm a Methodist. We don't drink. And he said, if my people found out, they'd kick me out of the church. Well, the doctor says, isn't there a time when you're by yourself? You can do it discreetly. Well, he's sitting here. Yeah, maybe when I shave. Perfect. Several months later, the doctor's down at the food store. Here comes the minister's wife. How's your husband? Oh, she said, he's doing well. He has so much energy. He's much more positive. He's really doing very well. He really has made a nice recovery. Oh, said the doctor, I'm so glad to hear that. But she said, I'm afraid the good doctor, the good minister, the good pastor might be having a little memory problem. Well, he said, why would you say that? She said, he shaves 8 times a day. Yeah. I'll see you next week.